From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for December 4th, 2016, the first Sunday in December. This is our weekly review of politics, and even though it's the holiday season, there's no shortage of subjects to talk about. Time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, you know, this time of year with the holidays, so many holiday parties to go to. It seems like there's one every day of the week. So many groups having their annual luncheons to coincide with the holiday season. And Dave and Sam, I was at one event Friday where Governor Rauner spoke to the Illinois Manufacturers Association. And as a special treat, they had Jim Cornelius and the Blackhawks National Anthem singer sing the anthem at the luncheon. And at the beginning, and he said, well, you know how to do it Blackhawk style. So of course everybody stood up and was cheering and applauding throughout. It was very impressive. But beforehand I was talking to Jim, who's a great guy, by the way, and we were just kind of chatting for a little bit, and I hadn't really met him all that well. And the coordinator of this luncheon was a guy from downstate who obviously didn't know anything about the Blackhawks or what goes on at the United Center, because as Jim and I are talking, the guy comes up to me and asks me if I'm the anthem guy.
Did you run with it?
No.
Yeah, that's right.
And actually, a friend of mine told him that, no, Rick sings when they want to empty the place. Which, that kind of hurt a little bit. I mean, I did sing the national anthem back at old Willowbrook High School for some of the basketball games and things, back when I could carry a tune. But it's hard enough carrying myself these days, you know. It was just fantastic to talk to him. And as I said, no shortage of news, because the governor sure made plenty of news over the events that have gone on over these last few days, and we'll get into
all. We could have some more today, later today, then.
Yeah, indeed. I will be leaving here at the when Dean takes over, and heading over to the Thompson Center to spend a lovely Sunday over at the JRTC on the 16th floor to see if the governor and the four leaders can put anything together as the clock approaches the end of the year and the end of the stopgap budget. But speaking of Cornelius and of course the Blackhawks, it didn't fare so well in Philly on that matinee game yesterday, which I don't know, it seemed like after the first period they decided to go back to sleep. But I have to tell you, the whole idea of Corey Crawford having his appendix removed and the Hawks having to get an emergency goalie, which I love this rule in the NHL. You know, it's like you can just pick up anybody off the street if you need to. Eric Zamborski, who earlier in the day was basically teaching kids hockey, when he gets a phone call from somebody with the Flyers saying, go grab your gear and head to the rink. He didn't know what was going on. And he shows up and he gets a call, and he's told that, you know, you're going to be the emergency backup for the Blackhawks. So they take a Corey Crawford jersey and take the Crawford off the number 50 and stitch his name on the back of it. And, you know, he played with Temple's club team and apparently had some notoriety there. But in fact, his parents, I guess they lived like 150 miles away, and with the rush, he got to the rink like 2 hours before game time. His parents couldn't even make it to watch him suit up for an NHL game.
Now, do they bring those letters on the road? How does that work? The Szymborski, how do you spell that? Do you have all these letters handy? That's the question I have.
Yeah, I think you do, because
you're not home. You're a long way from Chicago.
No, but and also it was an unusual because celebrating their 50th anniversary, the Flyers were wearing actually the whites and the Hawks were wearing their home reds. But you got to figure they do carry the letters with them because in case there's some trades or something that goes on, you've got to adapt real quickly.
Couldn't you get some of those letters that you used to use for a mailbox or your address, those stick-on things in a pinch?
Hey, this is the NHL. Come on.
But, Rick, that's what it takes to beat the first-place Blackhawks. You have to play them at noon, and the Crawford has to have an appendectomy.
That's right. That's right.
That's when they lose.
And they got off to such a great start, a quick start. I mean, they scored right into the game, and then it all went downhill from there. And unfortunately, since I was working yesterday as well, I didn't get to see the game, but it's probably best that I didn't. And hopefully we can rebound against Winnipeg tonight. I think I'm not sure what it's an early game time. Isn't
6 o'clock.
It? 6 o'clock game time. So, and of course, we'll have all the action right here on WGN with John and Troy. But just can you imagine? You know, he's Szymborski's 23 years old, and all of a sudden you're tapped. And there is actually, I saw some video of a post game interview, and actually during, I did see the first period, Kane was talking about how they had kind of were joking with him beforehand because he walked in. He wasn't wearing a suit, so he was going to get fined. And they also asked him for $200 for the holiday party. He said, you'll have to get it on credit instead. But one of the things I thought was real interesting is Jimmy Waite is the Blackhawks goaltender coach, but he couldn't be tapped to play because he's a former professional player. And as a result, he would have to be paid, and if they did pay him, it would exceed the Blackhawks' salary cap. That's pretty tight. I got to tell you that's how goofy some of the rules are. And but what a classic rule for the NHL. You know, just they could have picked up a beer vendor over at Wells Fargo Arena or something like that.
Now in goal for the Blackhawks, number 70, Rick Pearson.
I was available, but I didn't have I don't have the pads anymore, so they would have to do that.
They would have the letters for your name too, wouldn't they?
I would hope so. I mean,
and give you a number.
Yeah, well, and Szymborski said after the game that the Hawks lost 3-1, but the Hawks had pulled the goalie to try to, you know, late in the third period, and Szymborski said that if Philly had scored an open netter, that they were going to put him in for like the last minute of the game or something like that. That didn't happen, but wow, how exciting though! You know, it's I mean, he got some souvenirs, including he's going to get an official jersey, not the makeshift one. And he said he doesn't want his name on the Stanley Cup if the Hawks win. He just wants a ring.
Well, he's a lifelong Flyers fan.
Yes.
And
yes.
They asked him about that final, which ended in 2010, Game 6, the Patrick Kane goal that nobody could find right away.
Right.
He said that was one of the hardest things he ever had to watch as a sports fan.
Right. But then he added, today, that's all forgotten. I'm a Hawks fan. So it's all it takes is, you know, you put on a Hawks sweater. I'm sorry. There's nothing like it. That'll turn you into a fan right there. So we've got Hawks action coming up here on WGN at 6 o'clock. So stay tuned for that, and hopefully we can rebound from all of that. And as Sam said, a lot of football yesterday. I mean, nonstop football. And I was kind of curious about the start of that Bama game where Florida was getting points on the board, but Alabama obviously is just they're just too big a team. I mean, they could play in the NFL. Frankly, they should be playing at Soldier Field today.
They blocked that punt and then took it to the house, and then they had a pick six, and all of a sudden, like you said, Florida was up 7-0, and then before you know it, they're down 30.
Yeah, just like that. Just like that. I mean, so obviously the Alabama, the prohibitive favorites.
How do you not put Penn State in the playoff?
You know, you got to think.
I mean, if you put Ohio State, and I understand they're the number two team usually in the models right now, but they lost to Penn State.
Right. And
I mean, I don't know. The Big Ten champs, they beat Ohio State. They have like the 13th toughest schedule.
And, I mean, you know, Wisconsin was able to put some points on the board, but they just really got manhandled by Penn State. And this afternoon, I believe, is where we get the final four for the playoff picture.
Good luck. Somebody's going to be upset.
Oh, well. But, you know, you knew when they created this playoff system that it was – I mean, part of it was to create talk, but also it's also to create controversy as well.
You could have the champion of the best conference in college football not make the playoff.
Right. Right.
Riddle me that.
That's the great thing about sports, right?
Yeah.
that's why it is sports. Well, Dave is here to keep us up on all the news. Sam's here with the latest sports. Producer Jasmine is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200 or on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin and on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is grabbing the snow shovel here at the Mighty 720. And please stay tuned all day long, and we'll be giving you updates on our first, I guess, snow. I don't want to say significant snow, since I guess we're looking at 2 to 4 inches is the rough estimate.
2 to 4 is the rough estimate, depending on where you are, and an actual winter weather advisory until 6 o'clock tonight.
Well, it's December 4th.
It is December 4th. That's
I mean,
right.
Let's.
And then we had an earlier story that said that the state temperatures have been the warmest on record in Illinois since 1931. So all in all, think about that. You know, average it out.
Right, right. I mean, we've had some great weather, and yeah, I mean, a little snow, big deal. But do be careful out on the roads. I mean, we all know what that first kind of snow does to everybody's driving. So
we also had a couple fatal accidents from the last night and into early this morning. So, you know, with this first precipitation out there, yes, indeed, things could get slick. So do be careful.
Do be careful and do keep your radio tuned to WGN, and we'll be updating you on all the latest as far as weather. Up ahead, after Dave gives us a 7:30 news update, we're going to talk to former Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. Then after 8 o'clock, we'll be speaking with a good friend of the show, Elliot Richardson. He's the founder and CEO of the Small Business Advisory Council. And then after the 8:30 news, we'll speak to Professor David Merriman. David is part of the Fiscal Futures Project at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And he and retired Professor Dick Dye have a new report on Illinois' finances. And as you can imagine, the picture isn't pretty. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
That's the University of Illinois Rip Chords, as I always do, from a couple years ago. The premier women's a cappella group at the University of Illinois. And yes, okay, I'm starting to get into the spirit just a little bit. Against my better nature, as it were. But, of course, all that holiday goodwill will all probably go out the window when I go over to the Thompson Center to cover the leaders' meeting as they debate once again a state budget. We're going to kind of draw out a little bit our spin through national politics, but Donald Trump, the president-elect, continues working to assemble his cabinet. He hasn't named a Secretary of State. One of his harshest critics, former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney, is on the list to be considered. Here's what the former Massachusetts governor had to say after dining with Trump last week.
These discussions I've had with him have been enlightening and interesting and engaging. I've enjoyed them very, very much. I was also very impressed by the remarks he made on his victory night By the way, it's not easy winning. I know that myself. He did something I tried to do and was unsuccessful in accomplishing. He won the general election. And he continues with a message of inclusion and bringing people together. And his vision is something which obviously connected with the American people in a very powerful way.
That's former Massachusetts governor and former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney after meeting with Trump about potentially becoming Secretary of State, although there are reports from the AP now that former Utah Governor John Huntsman has been added to an expanded short list of people being under consideration. We'll talk more about the issue of Secretary of State and some of the divisions in the Trump camp later, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with former Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Well, last week, Chicago hit another grim milestone, exceeding 700 homicides for the first time in nearly two decades, and just seems like a year of relentless violence. And joining me on the phone is former Chicago Police Department Superintendent Gary McCarthy. Gary, thank you for getting up with me this morning.
Oh, good morning, Rick. And I was already up. I have a newborn at home. Don't forget that.
I was going to say congratulations, and I was wondering if your sleeping habits have been changing.
Yeah, I did a late one, and my wife gets up and does the early one, so she relieved me this morning. I got a couple of hours sleep, so I'm basically fresh as a daisy, as fresh as you could be with a 7-week old at home. Right.
Well, again, congratulations.
Thank you. It's really great.
I know you made some of the rounds of some of the local TV shows on Friday.
Yeah.
And I watched your appearance on Channel 9, and what struck me most was you kept saying, "Where is the outrage? Where is the outrage?"
Yeah, we can't take this as a new normal, and I don't see it happening. You know, I hearken back to, you know, a couple of years into my tenure, we got the murder number down to 1965 lows in this city. We did it back-to-back years in 2013 and 2014. And, you know, crime reduction is a process, and it takes some time. And it was underway, yet the entire time I felt enormous stress and pressure, because even though it was almost 90% lower than it is today, there was relentless pressure from the community, from elected officials, from the media to get those numbers lower and lower and lower. It was better, but it wasn't good, and it was nowhere near good enough. And it's just mind-boggling to me that people are kind of shrugging their shoulders. You know, the number 700 people, they didn't report it for 2 days in the press. I don't think, at least I caught it 2 days later, when somebody said, you know, Wednesday morning or Tuesday morning, we actually hit the 700 number, where, you know, as far as I recall, it was a lead up to every number we hit, whether it was 100, 200, or 250, or whatever the case was. And I'm wondering what has changed. We can't accept this as the new normal, because it's not normal, and it's not okay, and it doesn't have to be this way.
Well, what do you think has changed?
You know, a lot has changed. An awful lot has changed, but a lot has stayed the same. One of the things that I always used to talk about is the fact that the Chicago Police Department used to be an overly politicized organization. Well, I feel that it's gone right back to that. The political soup that has been created in the last couple of years around policing at the behest of saving black lives is causing black lives to be lost. That's what's happening. And there's a lot of accountability to go around for this. It goes from the Department of Justice to community leaders to quote-unquote community leaders. I always like to say that, because some are self-appointed in my book are really snake oil salesmen and don't necessarily represent the community.
You want to name some names?
Nah, I'm never going to do that.
Okay.
But you know what I'm talking about.
I know
about.
What
There's
you're talking
people
about.
Who
sure.
Really don't. Yeah, yeah. So to elected officials, and this goes top to bottom, because, you know, people want to try and legislate policing. Politics is a cancer in policing. It needs to be about performance. And the thing that I always talk about that people always ask me about is, why is New York doing so well? Why is it that when Chicago had the worst month ever, or in God knows how long, a couple of months ago in October, New York was touting that they had the lowest crime month ever on record? The reason is they didn't reverse course. And I want to take you back to the fact that New York had one of the first really high-profile deaths of African-American young men in Eric Garner.
Right.
And by the way, Rick, I also have to put the media into this. And Eric Garner is a case that really highlights the example. Eric Garner, as you recall, is the, quote, illegal chokehold death. And just to be clear, the chokehold was not illegal. It was against policy. It was not against the law. And he did not die from the chokehold. He died from compression from officers sitting on his back. So, but try and put that genie back in the bottle, because it's been sensationalized that it was an illegal chokehold death. And all of this has created an atmosphere of anti-police sentiment in this country that is not doing what we want it to do. And the other thing is this. You know, the police need to do better, period. I have to say that. It's my opinion. If you watch my City Club speech a while back, I said that I don't believe that really any, almost without exception, none of these young black men needed to die that we see the videos of. Not Laquan McDonald, not Eric Garner, not Michael Brown. None of them needed to die. With better tactics, better training, and better supervision.
Well, and that's
having said that,
I don't mean to interrupt, but I do. I mean, there is an accountability factor. I mean,
absolutely, and there is accountability. You know, Jason Van Dyke is charged with murder first degree. He's charged with murder first degree. Police shootings in the city of Chicago are less than half of 1% of the shootings. I want you to think about that. That means that 99.6% of the shootings in the city of Chicago do not involve the police. And that's not even saying that they're all unjustified. You know, how many are unjustified out of those? There's going to be a couple where officers have to be held accountable for either violations of policy or violations of the law. And there is accountability. But at the end of the day, what we're doing is that, you know, the police are not going to fix the ills of this society. We're looking at social and economic and class issues that are causing outrage. And if we keep pointing at the police and saying, let's fix police-community relations, it's not going to fix what's wrong in society. And in 5 years, we'll be having the same conversation.
Well, when we talk about accountability, and you mentioned about justifiable versus non-justifiable, I mean, certainly we had the controversy with the fact of IPRA and the fact that, for the most part, they didn't find any police-involved shooting as unjustified. When?
Yeah, and Rick, if you know the story, back in 2012, I tried to change the disciplinary system in the Chicago Police Department because it was one of the most dysfunctional that you can imagine. But here's the problem. Here's the problem, and this is where the politics comes in. If you listen to communities around the country, they want civilian oversight of police departments. Well, we have the police board in Chicago that is the final determiner of disciplinary matters, not the police superintendent. If you listen to communities around the country, they want outside agencies investigating shootings in the city of Chicago. Well, here in Chicago, we had IPRA. Now we have a different board. It's the same idea. Around this country, people want federal investigations into police shootings. Well, in the Laquan McDonald case, we still don't know the results of the federal grand jury that was impaneled. Does anybody even remember that the feds are investigating the Laquan McDonald case? And when you don't like the results, there's outrage. This is what people wanted. This is what we have in Chicago. But if we don't like the results, then there's outrage. So, you know, that's about politics.
And trying to please what people want.
Exactly. And it may not be what's best to do. Just like another example that I could give you is, in the very short term. All that investigation, the internal investigation by the Inspector General into the officer's actions at the scene of the Laquan McDonald murder, was administrative. He made recommendations to fire 10 officers to Eddie Johnson. Never in my 35 year of policing have I ever heard of an administrative case moving forward while a criminal or civil case is still underway, because you don't want to jeopardize it. Those 10 officers that the IG has now determined were not less than truthful or problematic with what they said, they're witnesses to a murder first degree prosecution that cannot testify at trial because their testimony has been completely impeached. You don't jeopardize a criminal case to please the public to take severe actions against officers if it's going to jeopardize that case. Just think about that. If Van Dyke is not convicted, that's going to be one of the major reasons right there. And we did it. And when I say we, I'm talking about the people, right? The politics dictated that something had to be done. So we changed the policy or overrode the policy, and the results are not going to be what people want.
We're speaking with former Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Then an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. Joining me on the phone is former Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. Gary, the idea of the politicalization of policing, I mean, there is kind of a fine line. You're saying it's just been crossed back over again, isn't it? I mean, politics is going to be endemic as part of a city function.
Yes, but it doesn't have to be to the degree that it is here. And you see, I have an experience, as you know. I wasn't born and raised in Chicago. It's my home now. I fell in love with the city the moment I got here. My daughter is here. I got remarried here, and now I have a son to raise here. So I want to see the city succeed. But it's my experience in the past, coming up through the NYPD, that we eliminated politics to the degree that it could be eliminated. It didn't affect the rank and file. The leadership of the department had to deal with it. I mean, I was deputy commissioner of operations for the NYPD and had to run crime strategy for New York for 7 years. And I worked under Rudy Giuliani. I worked under Mike Bloomberg. And I worked for Ray Kelly, Howard Schaefer, and a whole bunch of other police commissioners. But the performance of the department and the performance of the individuals was way more important than the politics. And, you know, somebody even as tough as Rudy Giuliani is, he would always defer to performance and what was practical to get things done as far as reducing crime and saving lives, rather than kowtowing to the politics. And we can't do that. Not if you expect results, right? Because if you want results, then you look at performance. If you want politics, then you don't look at performance. And that's what's happening here. And I used to talk about the fact that Chicago is overly politicized. It's back to being overly politicized. Decisions are being made that affect that department that are happening outside the department on 100 different levels. And the results are tragic. You know, I got fired on December 1st of last year, and there have been 737 people murdered since then, 737, which is a almost 90% increase from 2 years ago. That's outrageous. People are literally dying because of the actions that we're taking, by misdiagnosing a problem, by pointing at the police and saying that this is the problem that's happening in society. We're investigating police, not criminals now. And the results are that people are dying. It's not working. And I feel like sometimes I'm screaming into a vacuum when I say this. But fortunately, you know, people still reach out to me when these things happen, because they're interested in my perspective, because it's different than what we're accustomed to here in Chicago.
So what should we be doing that we're not doing?
Well, first of all, if you're going to solve any problem, you have to first properly
identify it.
Yeah, and the police are not the problem in society today, simply put. And I'm overstating it. There are obviously issues in policing, and police leadership is addressing it moving forward. The police leadership in this country is not your grandfather's police chief where, you know, they were tribal leaders and, you know, they're going to rule the roost with an iron fist. No, they're more like executives of Fortune 500 companies today. They're well-educated. They share best practices. You know, we participated in the president's 21st Century Task Force on Policing, and they took 92% of what we do and made them recommendations for police departments across the country. Yet the Department of Justice comes here to investigate our patterns and practices when they were actually bringing people here to look at what it is we were doing. This is completely political. We know how to reduce crime. We know how to work with the community in policing, but it's being dictated by elected officials. It's being dictated by the Department of Justice, and they're using standards that are beyond the pale of what the Supreme Court has decided. So this is affecting policing in a hundred different ways. We should go back to what we were doing, if it was working, and eliminate the things that were not working. But that's not what has happened. We've completely reversed field. And that's why Los Angeles and New York have less murders combined than Chicago right now, because they have not reversed field. They've stayed with those best practices. They've moved forward with it. And it's working.
As you talk about the politicalization affecting policing, how much of that is just because, let's face it, you became the fall guy with Laquan McDonald?
Well, I think that was part of the politics of the scenario. You know, people always, I was recently asked, why were you fired? And I said, you know what? I was never actually really given a reason. You know, it's a step that, you know, right after it happened with me, it happened with a friend of mine, Greg Sir, who's police chief out in San Francisco. Same thing, police-related shooting, police chief gets fired. That's probably a tried-and-true practice in the past. You cut off the heads below you to try and save yourself. Maybe they do that in private industry also. I've never really worked in private industry until the last year. But that's not going to solve anything. You know, one of the things that I say, and it may sound offensive to some people, but when you negotiate with terrorists, you empower your enemy. And that's why we don't do it in this country. And sometimes you have to stand up and say, look, this is what happened. This is what we're going to do. And it's the right thing to do. It's not the politically expedient thing to do. And unfortunately, you know, I think that that action that was taken, my firing, was the first in a huge political deck of cards that is just kind of crumbling down on the department, and it's destroying it.
That's Chicago, former Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. Gary, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's a pleasure, Rick. Thanks very much. It's almost cathartic to have these conversations, but I just need to see something happen about it.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts, and we'll have you back on anytime. Thank you so much.
Sounds great. Thanks, Rick. Bye.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Elliot Richardson, the founder and co-CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council, and we'll talk about Springfield's action or inaction, the effect that has had on small businesses.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Donald Trump making kind of a victory thank you lap. Not this weekend, but he started last week, and he'll pick that up again on Tuesday. But, of course, one of his big stops was in Indianapolis to discuss his negotiation with United Technologies and the carrier over keeping some of those jobs, a significant number, but still some of those jobs that the company had planned to send to Mexico.
Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences. Not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Tell you right now. we're losing our that we're losing so much. So one of the things we're doing to keep them is we're going to be lowering our business tax from 35%, hopefully down to 15%, which would take us from the highest tax nation virtually in the world. This is terrible for business. To one of the lower tax, not the lowest yet, but one of the lower tax.
So this morning, the president-elect was back on his favorite messaging vehicle, Twitter, to say that the U.S. is going to substantially reduce taxes and regulations on businesses, but any business that leaves our country for another country, fires its employees, builds a new factory or plant in the other country, and then thinks it will sell its product back in the U.S. without retribution or consequence is wrong. There will be a tax soon on our strong border of 35% for these companies wanting to sell their product, cars, AC units, etc., back across the border. This tax will make leaving financially difficult, but these companies are able to move between all 50 states with no tax or tariff being charged. Please be forewarned. He said any company planning to move jobs is making an expensive mistake. Quote, the United States is open for business, unquote. That's the president-elect in a kind of a Twitter blast after Saturday Night Live kind of used his propensity for Twitter as its cold open last night. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is a good friend of the show, Elliot Richardson. He's the founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council, and that's an organization aimed at improving the economic climate for small business in the state of Illinois. Elliot, thank you so much.
Rick, thank you so much for having me.
You know, it seems like we could just replay the last time we talked here,
yep.
Given the fact that we went through the veto session. We still have discussions underway between the governor and the legislative leaders. We have a stopgap budget plan that expires with the new year, with the end of this year. And we're no closer to any kind of resolution.
You're 100% right. It's like Groundhog Day over and over and over again. And what's going on in Springfield is really pathetic. You know, we represent small businesses throughout the state of Illinois. And what we want to do is we want some certainty. We want our government to work. We don't want them to be the problem. We want them to get out of the way and let us run our businesses. And right now, what's going on in Springfield is making it very difficult for small business owners to make decisions. It's impacting their clients and their customers, whether that's nonprofits, whether it's other companies that are talking about leaving the state. And this uncertainty cripples, it paralyzes small businesses. And then when we also look at the overall economy of the state of Illinois, and you see us falling deeper into debt, losing millions of dollars, every day our politicians in Springfield cannot come to common sense resolutions to our issues. It's mind-boggling. And the only word for it is pathetic, and it needs to change, Rick.
But what's going to make it change? I mean, we had this kind of timeout after the legislature adjourned in May and a, kind of this agreed-to timeout, and we're going to have the election. And we saw that, you know, come January, there will be a few seats that change. But basically, the fundamental structure of Democrats controlling the legislature, a Republican governor, that doesn't change. And to do anything, you need 60 votes in the House and 30 votes in the Senate.
So the proposals are out there. The compromises are out there. And at this point, after pushing to end this budget impasse for almost 2 years now, you know, most of our members have come to the conclusion that are engaged in the political process that it's not going to happen from leadership. The way to solve this is going to have to be putting pressure on people's individual legislators, the rank-and-file senators and representatives in people's districts, and making the masses more important to them than leadership. Because it just does not seem, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, we're a nonpartisan group, it does not seem that leadership on either side is listening. Because what we're saying is there's proposals, there's initiatives that are out there. We could get together. You guys need to get together. Get yourselves in a room, get a whiteboard, and solve it like business owners do, like nonprofits do, who are trying to figure out how to work with underprivileged kids. Anybody who runs an organization understands problem solving and moving forward is essential. And right now, the leadership of both parties doesn't seem willing to do that. So the way to solve it, political pressure, grassroots pressure on rank-and-file legislators.
We're talking with Elliot Richardson from the Small Business Advocacy Council. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Some weird Christmas music via my friends over at Mental Floss. That's from the 1979 album Dear Santa, Let's Disco.
There you go.
It's hard to believe. You listen to that, you wonder how disco ever got so popular. I have to tell you. But Elliot Richardson is here with me. He's the founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. We're talking about the continued impasse in Springfield. And Elliot, you were talking about when you talk to rank-and-file legislators and they say there's room to compromise, there's room to, you know, to reach agreements, and that it needs a groundswell of support from the bottom up kind of thing. The question I have, though, is has that dynamic changed? Because when you look at the November election, and I'm not talking about the results, I'm talking about the money.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And when you're looking at the millions and millions of dollars spent on each side, and that's money, basically that's loyalty and allegiance money, that how can a rank and file lawmaker or are any willing to buck up against all of that money and the resources, knowing what's going to be coming at them for being disloyal?
So, you know,
And we've always talked about the power of the legislative leaders, but now you throw in the governor and his allies, and I'm not singling him out. I'm just saying it's a new dynamic here that, as Republicans say, well, now we're on an equal balance with Democrats.
Yeah, you know, when I was listening to that disco music, I was thinking a way to end the budget impasse is
let them play that
over and over again in a room with the leaders until they come to a compromise. You know, when you talk to rank-and-file legislators, I think what they're looking for is for the public to provide them the cover and the support to make them move. There was a ridiculous, disgusting amount of money spent in the last election on negative ads. I mean, the number escapes me. I know it was really high because we posted about it. But and then, you know, you expect these people who beat the heck out of each other for months during an election to get into a room and compromise, but they have to do it. And there is one thing that can trump money, no pun intended, and that is people. And that is grassroots getting out and letting legislators know that if they don't push their leadership to solve this, no matter how much money they've got, they're going to lose the election.
But what we've still haven't seen in these 2 years, now, sure, there's the interests of businesses and small businesses, many of whom are vendors to the state.
Absolutely.
I mean, not just the ancillary things, but you have that. But the regular person isn't feeling any effect, any ill effects of this. I mean, sure, let's say you have a university closed downstate that devastates the economy of a small town. I mean, we've already saw from the legislature one of the things they did do was the subsidies and what we're going to pay as ratepayers, both residential and commercial, to keep two nuclear power plants open, that the governor says, well, that was about the jobs in Clinton and the Quad Cities, about and the devastation that could have caused there. But you look at some of these, you look at what universities, higher education has downstate, Eastern Illinois, here, you know, Chicago State, the effect, you know, that has on economies.
The whole thing's interrelated. Kids not getting their MAP grants. If you're a business owner and you don't know whether or not your child's going to get a MAP grant, right? Do you make a hire? I mean, if you're a vendor, there's going to be $13 billion in unpaid bills by this summer that are owed by the state of Illinois, and a lot of that's to small businesses. If you never know when you're going to get paid, if there's no certainty there, how can you hire somebody? How can you move into a bigger space? If you're not going to move into a bigger space, how can you use other small and large businesses to furnish your new space, to get your telephones, to buy your computers? It all impacts the economy. And what I would say is you're right, Rick. There has not been the groundswell yet of people saying, end this budget impasse because it impacts me. But the question is, how low does the state have to go before people start to say enough is enough? How many people does it need to affect? I mean, it's already hit the social service world. It's hit colleges. It's hit kids getting their MAP grants.
It's hit nonprofits.
It's hit nonprofits hard. And now when some of these nonprofits start going out of business and a small business owner says, man, I'm losing revenue because of the nonsense that's going on in Springfield, does that get people going? You know, it's got to end at some point. And it's going to take a groundswell of people sort of rising up and saying, solve this problem, to end what is an unprecedented budget impasse. I don't know that folks realize how unprecedented this really is in Illinois. I think it's the longest period without a real budget that any state's had in a remarkably long period of time. And we're losing millions of dollars every day. Every day.
Plus, as small businesses, too, and what you're finding, and we've seen this here in Chicago with Mayor Emanuel, is like, well, you know, I can't count necessarily on Springfield for stuff. So that involves raising revenues in different venues. And you know, when you hear talk about the governor on his agenda is a property tax freeze, I talked to one mayor who said, well, you know, that wouldn't necessarily impact me all that great because I can always raise a tax on something else. And schools can't do that.
You're 100% right. And the deeper into debt we go, we know there's going to be pain on the other side. And that causes this uncertainty that has caused people to leave the state. And that's not anecdotal anymore, Rick. That's serious. I know people who have moved their business out of Illinois. I know folks who have moved their residence out of Illinois and kept their business in the state, but the state continues to lose revenue. It's like a zero-sum game. We're going down the rabbit hole, and we need our folks in Springfield to solve it. And in terms of solving it, I want to be very, very clear. There are proposals out there. Compromise, common sense proposals on workers' compensation, on beginning to chip away at the pension debt in a constitutional way. I mean, there are laws and proposals that are floating, and we just need somebody, some brave leader, some politician to grab it and start pushing it. And I think people would have something to get behind. But it's not hopeless. People just actually want to solve the problem. And the question is right now, do our leaders really want to solve the problems that are ailing the state, or is it all politics aimed towards 2018?
And what do you think?
I think the verdict's out. Now, I think the way that the leaders are acting, it's way too political and not nearly enough problem solving, and people are getting hurt. And that's so wrong. I mean, this state is not a political pawn. The people in it are not political pawns. And our leaders need to start doing the right thing and beginning to solve the issues. So I'm not optimistic about what the leaders might do, and I hope I'm wrong, but I am optimistic about what the people of Illinois and the business owners in Illinois can do to put pressure, great political pressure, on their legislators to start to get this thing solved.
Well, 2018 is the Illinois bicentennial. We don't know if there will be an Illinois by 2018.
We're not falling into Lake Michigan. We're going to be here, and I think people will get engaged.
That's Elliot Richardson. He's the founder and co-CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Elliot, always good to have you here.
Rick, we so much appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Professor David Merriman. He's with the Fiscal Futures Project at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And I'm joined by Professor David Merriman from the Fiscal Futures Project, which is part of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. David, thank you as always for joining me.
Thanks. It's really nice to be here.
And you co-authored the latest Fiscal Futures Project report with our good friend Richard Dye. Dick Dye, retired now. And what a way to go out with this report, I have to tell you. You know, we all know we're in a sad shape. But, you know, when you entitle a report, first you have to stop the digging. There's no sign that it's stopping.
Right. And that's really what motivated us to do this now, was to stress the urgency of it and also try and make the point to people that we have to stop digging. This isn't going to be solved at one time. It's going to take sustained effort to do it over a long period of time and a combination of things and a lot of sacrifice on all sides. The people who want higher taxes, you know, think that the solution is higher taxes. Yes, we're going to need those. But unfortunately, we're also going to need spending cuts, you know, or certainly restraint in terms of spending. And it's going to be painful.
Well, let's just quickly highlight the fact that in the report, your study finds a deficit of approximately $13 billion for fiscal year 2017. That's in the next fiscal year.
Right. The year we're in the middle of right now, we've gone half of 2017. And we think, given sort of the current trends, that's what's going to happen, a $13 billion deficit, which is on total spending of about $76 billion. So, you know, it's way out of whack.
13 of 76.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we can't, you know, it's
that
not,
was David laughing as I rolled my eyes there, yes.
I mean, it's not reasonable to believe you could do that much cutting, you know, even if you wanted to, you know, there isn't that much waste, fraud, and abuse. And even if you were really willing to make some hard cuts, you can't do that in one year, right? This is going to take something where we have to phase it in. And even if we were to start putting in some revenue increases, some tax increases, the money's not going to come in that fast. It's going to take time.
And as you point out, and we'll get this a little further, but there could be some deleterious effects on the economic climate with any kind of a tax increase.
Right. Well, we think there's deleterious effects from the inaction, but there also could be deleterious effects from any action, from increasing taxes or from cutting spending. Both of those things can have, of course, can be very costly. So you have to do it carefully. So we've looked at a variety of mechanisms. And the first thing we looked at was just cutting spending. And what we looked at was cutting the rate of growth of spending by 2% below the rate that we project, the sort of historical rates of growth in spending. And even if we did that and we kept it up for about a decade, which would make spending about 20% below what it would have been in the absence of these cuts, we've still only closed something like a third to half of the deficit. So spending cuts alone, even sustained spending cuts for a long time, aren't going to be enough. If we look at tax increases, we looked at a variety of tax increases, from increasing the personal and corporate income tax. It's currently 3.75% to 4.75%. That in itself is going to be nowhere near enough. It's going to help. We looked at expanding the tax base, the income tax base, the tax retirement income. Again, we get some funds from that, but not enough. We looked at increasing the sales tax base to tax some services. Right now, we tax most goods transactions, but not services. Even if we do all of those things together, the spending cuts, the income tax increases, changing the income tax base, changing the sales tax base, that's not quite enough. We'd also need to get a little bit of economic growth, which we might. You just heard the previous guest in here talking about the how the inaction is you know hampering economic growth. If we did all of that and we can manage to sustain it for a decade, we think we might get back to budget balance. But it's a very tall order. It's a very tall order when we can't get political consensus really on even much more minor kinds of changes.
Right. And, you know, not calculated into this is, you know, where goest pensions. I mean, you're making the assumption of where we are now as far as pensions.
Right. So for pensions, there's a schedule for the pension payments that'll be made. If we stick to that schedule, the actuaries tell us that if we stick to that schedule until about 2045, the pensions will be 90% funded, which is doable. We're hoping the actuaries have got the numbers right, and we don't know what's going to happen in the stock market, et cetera. But you know, these figures that we're talking about are pretty optimistic. That difficult picture that I told you is actually we're making some optimistic assumptions there. But you know, we've dug this big hole for ourselves, so it's going to take a while to get out, and there's going to be some pain.
And long-term, long-sustained pain.
Long-sustained pain. And the way I think we're going to be able to, you know, get this sustained effort is kind of to try and build some trust, both among the different political parties, but also in the general populace that, look, we have to do this. We've looked at it seriously. We know it's going to be painful, but over a period of time, we can get there. So we've tried to look at some mechanisms that might be used.
Don't jump ahead just yet.
Okay.
I want to come back to that. But
we're
speaking to Professor David Merriman from the Fiscal Futures Project at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
At the Waffle House on Christmas, my true love gave to me 5 pork chops grilled. 4 eggs of fried.
3 sausage patties, 2 waffles baking, and a bowl of delicious hot grits.
At the Waffle House on Christmas, my true love gave to me 6 different omelets,
5 pork chops grilled. 4 eggs of fry and 3 sausage patties, 2 waffles baking, and a bowl of delicious hot grits.
That's some more of our weird Christmas music this morning. That's from At the Waffle House on Christmas from the 2001 CD. So a little disco, a little Waffle House. What better way to get your Sunday morning started? We're speaking with David Merriman. He's a professor at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, co-author of the Fiscal Futures Project report on the increasingly deep hole that Illinois is digging itself into due to its lack of a budget. We've got backlog of bills, $10 billion. We talked about pensions. You also add the issue of health care, too, which is a significant factor.
Right.
A legacy cost, $174 billion. Everybody says you can't do it all in one day. You were saying about we're in a need for a lengthy period. It's not going to be pretty, but if you hit the target, there can be light at the end of the tunnel. It's just how do you hit that target? And obviously the propensity of politicians is if there's tax money or there's money to find a way to spend it. And that's a major fear.
Right. I mean, that's the political logic. It's a hard vote to have to vote to raise taxes on your constituents.
Without having something to show for it.
Without having something to show for it. And unfortunately, we're in the position where we can't do that. If we bring in new revenue, we can't have new spending because we're already behind. What we've got to do is pay off some of the old bills and get enough revenue to pay for the spending that we're already doing.
Because we're at an unsustainable level. And right. Even in your models where you talk about cuts of anticipated spending, I mean, we are under, you know, various rules that spending is there's a natural increase in spending in certain programs and mostly in expensive programs.
Right. Well, some of the spending, for instance, the programmed pension spending, there's a ramp that, you know, raises pension spending over time. You know, there's certain expenses for health care, and we've had, in particular, Medicaid, so we've had some of those costs go up. K-12 education, I mean, I think there's a general consensus that the state needs to contribute at least as much, if not more, than it is now to local governments. So there's a number of areas where we really can't cut. I mean, one of the things that passed in November was a constitutional amendment which says the transportation revenue has to go to transportation. So that's also cut our ability.
Or taken off the table, basically, for filling some of the holes.
Right, right. So, you know, we've constrained ourselves in lots of ways, and we've programmed that into the model. And that's one of the reasons why there's limits to what we can do with spending cuts.
So how can we get on this diet and follow the diet without somebody deciding, oh, well, here's some money here. Let's try this.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what we need to do is build in some mechanisms that assure people who, you know, are going to reluctantly go along with tax increases or reluctantly go along with spending increases, that it's really going to help to solve the problem. And so in other places, the U.S. Congress at the federal level has been trying to build in these mechanisms. They've put in some kind of rules, and we call them triggers, so that you set some kind of target that says if you don't meet some level of, for instance, reducing the deficit, some budget balance target, then there's automatic cuts that go into effect or automatic tax increases. That kind of gives everyone assurance that you're serious about this, and those, you know, since they want to avoid, you know, the automatic kind of
triggers,
you know, you hope that that pushes them towards compromise.
Because if those triggers click in, it's politically unpleasant.
It's going to be unpleasant. So, you know, exactly what the triggers would be in Illinois, that's something for the legislature to talk about. But I think we're going to need some kind of mechanism like that. We should be talking about mechanisms like that so that everybody sort of knows it's a sustained period. And I think that would do a lot to increase, you know, public confidence that we're in it for the long haul, and small businesses
and that new revenues are going to be used to pay off old debts,
right?
Not
right.
For new programs,
right?
Not for expanded government,
right? Right, because I think at this point we just don't have the money to do that. Not necessarily that expanded government is a bad thing, but we're not there. We don't have the money to do it.
One of the things that you looked at as far as these enforcement mechanisms dealt with bond covenants. Can you just quickly?
So this is an idea that has not been tried, but I think really could make some sense to talk about. So the state of Illinois is going to have to do some bonding, probably even to pay off unpaid bills. Now we have $13 billion, or we will by the end of the fiscal year, probably have $13 billion of unpaid bills. You know, these are owed to vendors. They're owed to nonprofits all over the state. How are we going to pay those off? We're probably going to have to borrow money. So one possibility is when you sell those bonds to have a covenant that says, okay, the bonds can be called, which means the states would have to pay them off more quickly if they don't reach some kind of certain trigger. So, for instance, it could be if the state falls out of budget balance by some measure, those bonds would be called and the states would have to make immediate payments. This idea has been proposed by Richard Ravitch, who's the former lieutenant governor in New York. And that would be, you know, it's such a harsh result if the bonds were called that it might help give some discipline to the fiscal process.
And kind of put the political fear of God in some folks.
Right. And also give the politicians some cover to say, look, you know, I would love to fund your program, or I would love to agree to this tax cut, but I can't do it because if I do it, there's going to be the bond covenant's going to click in, and suddenly I'm going to have to this huge bill, and I have no way to pay it.
And yeah, and the earth opens up and swallows all of us.
Right, right.
Professor David Merriman from the Fiscal Futures Project and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, as always, thank you so much for joining
thanks.
Me this morning.
It's good to be here. And thanks for what you do, Rick, in informing the public about these issues. I appreciate it.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Gary McCarthy, Elliot Richardson, and Professor David Merriman. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. Now I will be heading over to the James R. Thompson Center to, once again, Dean, as I say, I do it so you don't have
to. Quit trying to make us all jealous.
Well, I figure as an alternative to watching the Bears.
Well, that's true.
You know, I mean,
you could think one thing less painful.
I'm trying to look for the positive in these things.
Wow.
You know?
And all I did was go to the Skywalker Ranch. I saw a portion of the new Star Wars movie.
Really?
Over the weekend.
Yeah?
How weird is this? They invite us to the Skywalker Ranch, which is unbelievable.
I bet. Fabulous.
Unbelievable to be in this historic place. And then, we think we're going to interview the whole cast.
Right.
But they only show us 28 minutes of the movie because they want to keep some of it secret, closer to the opening date.
Really?
It's frustrating.
Yeah, because how can you give it any context?
Right. Now I have to see it again before I review it.
Right.
But I would have liked to have seen the whole thing while I was there.
Was it sections of it? Or was it 28 minutes
no,
and then cut?
Sections.
Oh, so it's like you can't tune out for 28
right.
minutes and yeah. then catch up.
Right. I'm not complaining. I was at the Skywalker,
you were at the Skywalker Ranch. But...
I was at the Skywalker Ranch, and I saw 28 pretty impressive minutes of this movie. I was a little hesitant about this whole standalone movie thing. I wasn't sure if I liked the whole idea.
Right.
But with these 28 minutes, again, it's 28 minutes, so... The rest of the hour and a half that I did not see may be awful. I doubt it is.
Right.
But
it's secret.
So far, I'm pretty impressed.
But it's secret.
And they've just got me talking about their movie for mission accomplished, Disney.
Could you send me those 28 films? Minutes while I go over to the Thompson Center?
That's right. Exactly
I
right.
I could use some outwardly experience.
We did interview the cast, though, yesterday in San Francisco. And we had some great interviews. We're going to share those with you today. We've got the star of Hamilton coming in today. Miguel Cervantes is coming in today as well. We've got and maybe top of the whole A-list today, meteorologist Mike Hamernick throughout the program. Because it's about to snow, my friends.
Well, I'm going to be listening on my WGN app on my phone.
That's the way
How
to
about
keep
that.
That's the way to keep the boredom down. Sure.
Have a great show.
Make your life feel better in comparison.